So we have maybe about 25 minutes till 8 o'clock, so we can do questions and answers and comments and things. Yep?
On the last point that you raised regarding...
The question is... Right. The question is how... I have to repeat the questions for the thing. Okay. Is about the trade-off between inflation and unemployment, and if we keep the unemployment rate low, will that jack up inflation? And similarly, you know, could we afford to have a lot more inflation and then maybe keep the unemployment rate lower than it is? I think some important issues here. If we go back to the like mid-1990s, if you asked almost every reputable economist in the country what the lowest the unemployment rate could go before we would start to see a lot of inflation above 3%, and rising each year that we stayed below, they would almost all have said 6 to 6.5%. There were a few exceptions among the reputable economists. And on the left, where we have some reputable economists, and then we have some people who are perceived not to be reputable, there was a widespread belief we could go a lot lower than that. That people were saying we could go to 3% or 2.5% or 3 or 3.5 or certainly 4. Now, what the experience of the late 1990s completely vindicated that view, essentially by a series of you could argue, brilliant thinking on the part of Alan Greenspan, or you could argue a little bit of luck and a little bit of courage and a few odds and ends of a few developments. The unemployment rate crept down below 6%. Looked around, there wasn't any inflation. Got down to 5.5, still no inflation. 5, still nothing. We basically got to 4%, and we kept at that level, which was 2.5 percentage points lower than every economist in the country would have said was the level, not every, but a large chunk of economists would have said was where we could go. And what did we see? We saw essentially no increase that was significant in inflation, and big increases in wages after you adjust for inflation, and incomes for people across the board. My argument wouldn't be so much in favor of let's have 10% inflation. It would be let's be realistic about how low the unemployment rate can go before we actually do face inflation, particularly in a context where we're having large productivity growth. I mean, you can afford to increase workers' wages when productivity is growing rapidly without increasing prices. What we're experiencing right now is not so much, the unemployment rate, if you look at it, is not as bad as it's been in the past. But what we did see also was a big decline in the share of people who have a job. So people don't have a job anymore, but they're not unemployed by the strict definition of what unemployment is. And I think that we have more slack in the labor market now than we seem to. I'm not as averse to inflation as most people, but 10% I would start. You know, at least until my mortgage, which is nominally denominated, of course, like everybody's, you know, when that got sorted out, then I'd say we got to stop this inflation now. But you know, anyway. Any other questions, comments? In the back? Yep. Yeah. The question is, what's the relationship between, say, wages or hourly compensation, which is wages plus benefits, productivity growth, and unit labor costs? Which is a whole nother concept, which is related to productivity. I don't want to have too technical of a conversation. We can talk about it afterwards. But I'd say that from a political perspective, the most important relationship is the fact that from the end of World War II to about the mid-1970s, if productivity went up 2 or 3%, so the workers' output per hour goes up 2 or 3%, over the long period, not every single year, but over that broad period, workers' wages went up by 2 or 3%. That basically meant that, you know, employers were getting more money. They were getting their share of the 2 or 3% increase. Workers were getting their share of the 2 or 3% increase, and things were trundling along pretty well. And then I think what happens is at the end of the 1970s, well, starting in the 1970s and by the end of the 1970s, that relationship starts to break down, and it's broken down terribly since then. And that, to me, is the important political issue of all of this, is that we're having big increases in the amount of work the amount of output that workers produce in an hour's worth of work and what they actually get paid. Now, there's all sorts of complicated issues about the proper deflator, the way you adjust for inflation between these various things, and we can talk about that afterwards. But for me, that's the key issue, is that for a really long time, our institutions allowed workers to share pretty much equally in the benefits of the of increases in productivity of what they did for their hours worth of work. And that since then, the institutions that we have not been amenable to that. In fact, they've really, you know, broken that long-term relationship. Todd?
You had a graph that you didn't get to in the talk on prison population.
Yeah.
Well,
there are about three or four graphs at the end, which the question that Todd has is about the graph I have on the printout, the handout that talks about the prison population. Basically, I viewed that there are four graphs at the end, or three graphs at the end, which I didn't talk about at all, or tables. And the reason was I had to make another copy of a page, so I had three extra spaces that we could use. So I put propaganda in there instead of an ad for ExxonMobil or something. I thought, okay, here's some things that I think are important, and one of them is, you know, one of the most depressing aspects of the U.S. economic model of the last 25 years is just the massive increase in prison population. We have over 2 million, mostly men, about 1.9 million men, I think, in prison. And that's just terrible. You could argue that it's maybe the corollary or the gender analog of welfare reform, which is mostly about women. So poor women, you make go and work at substandard wages, and poor men, especially if they're really difficult, you just put them in jail. But, you know, I've stepped a little bit outside of the economics realm and into what I think usually over beers.
Well,
but
does it have any effect on wages or any of these things?
It's hard to say. On the one hand, you're reducing the labor supply, so you might say it's jacking up low-wage workers' wages. On the other hand, you might say it's a heck of an intimidating effect on, like, maybe I should just toe the line in my crappy job because I don't want to end up in the streets and then, you know, in a life of crime and then in jail.
But
so
is it the cost of $40,000 a year?
The question is, does it cost $40,000 a year to keep someone in? Yeah, it sounds. I mean, I don't know. It's a lot of money, and it's more money than probably keeping them in a job where they pay some taxes. You have a question in the back. I keep skipping you. Sorry. Okay. The question is, what would the tax policy changes do to the numbers that we've seen so far, which are all after taxes, or before taxes? Sorry. The main difference for most of the period is that they would exaggerate what we've seen. And the reason why you can say that very clearly is because mostly what we've seen from Reagan and from Bush, the George Bush II, is, you know, are basically tax cuts which are disproportionately aimed at the top or that just tier right below that. So if you take, and to a certain degree, even tax increases at the bottom during the Reagan administration to a certain degree. So what that would do is it would just widen the inequality that happened. There was a bit of a move back. People at the top 1% started paying more taxes under Bill Clinton, and that's sort of obviously been eroded in the last few years. So there would maybe that would affect things a little bit. The one thing that I didn't talk about too much was the issue of, you know, where did the money go? And I kind of left it, you know, if you have these huge increases in productivity and even the 90th percentile is not doing that well or the 95th percentile is not doing that well, where did it go? And this touches on it a little bit. The quick answer to that is it went to people who are above the 95th percentile, the 96th, the 97th, 98th, 99th percentile. And we don't have good data to measure what's happening up there, so it's hard to put up. And the other people that it went to are the employers. People's, you know, profits have increased relative. And those things, profits are taxed a lot less now than they used to be taxed. The question is whether unemployment is being measured well. I think the short answer is that unemployment, exactly as it's defined by the Bureau of Labor Statistics based on the International Labor Organization definitions, is measured pretty well. The question is, you know, what is the social meaning of unemployment, and is that changing and over time, and are we capturing that well? And I kind of alluded to it a little bit before that, you know, one of the big things about this recession and this kind of lackluster recovery that we're experiencing right now is that the unemployment rate is relatively low by historical standards, but if you look just at that number, you're going to miss a lot of important aspects of the economy. In particular, we still have about 2 percentage points of fewer people working than we used to have, you know, as a share of the population has fallen by two full percentage points. The unemployment rate has not increased by that amount. Essentially what has happened is people who used to be working left their job or lost their job, and they've given up, or they've decided to go to school instead of working because their working opportunities aren't there, or they've just, you know, said, oh, there's no jobs, I'll look again when there's jobs. And those people typically are not counted as being unemployed, so we're not fully getting at the issue of labor market slack. Then you have a whole bunch of other issues, and various people at the New School, for example, the Short Center for Economic and Policy Analysis has a new indicator that they're putting up on their webpage periodically, which looks at broader definitions of unemployment, things about discouraged workers or low-wage workers in very low-productivity jobs. And I think those kinds of indicators are potentially very helpful in terms of giving a broader picture of what unemployment is really, you know, what labor market slack beyond just the unemployment rate is. So, the question is whether, you know, the concept of family income adequately captures reality. Is that a fair? And if there's other breakout, yes, there are a million descriptions of what's happened over the last long period of time. And you know, just to make a simple distinction, families by the census definition are two or more related people living together in a household sharing, and you know, whereas a household could, and it's two or more people in a family. So if there are households, like that excludes, for example, all single people are excluded from the numbers that I showed you earlier. The reason why I do that is because the family income series is the only series that's been taken continuously from the end of World War II to the present. Since the mid-1960s, we look at households, which allow for much more of the breakdowns that you're alluding to, things like single people or single earners or mothers with kids or fathers with kids, or there's a lot more breakdowns. But that data is only available in a consistent basis from the end of the 1960s, so it misses some of the long-term trend that I'm trying to show here. And they provide a much richer and much better way of looking at things without actually in any way contradicting. If you look at the median household income, basically all it does is it shifts down the numbers from about 1967 to here, but the trends are very similar. So I would agree that from a social policy analysis perspective, the graph that I showed you is very inadequate. I think from the perspective of trying to show sort of a basic feel of what's happened over the period, I think it's a reasonable approximation to reality. But, David?
I actually have a couple of questions. I'm going to play a little bit of the devil's advocate here just for our internet audience and folks who are going to argue with some of the assertions that you make. First question is, what is the source of your data? Is this all government sources?
The first question is what the source of the data is. I don't know. There's a lot of different. There is a paper which is over here and available, and it's going to be online as well, that has a much more complete description of all of the numbers that I put up. Essentially, every number that I put up, the ultimate source is some government survey. Sometimes I've just taken numbers straight from published sources. Other times I've taken the microdata and analyzed it and put that up. I don't think too much of what I put up in terms of the numbers would be that controversial. I think it's, you know, what would upset people is likely my interpretation of the numbers. If someone has a particular disagreement, you know, I'd be happy to talk with them about that, and we could go back and forth. But, you know, some of it's just you pull a number and you put it up, and that's what it is. And, you know, and I say it's a half empty, and they say it's half full, and you know, it's something like that.
Okay. And another related to that, why did you choose 1979 as the point where you were going to, set the bar at 100? Because especially the woman's chart was, if you had just shifted it back 3 years,
mm-hmm.
the chart would have looked completely different. You would have mm-hmm. you would have had a much sharper growth increase for the I think the bottom
mm-hmm.
10th percentile.
So the question is why I chose 1979, and as sort of the breakpoint for a lot of the things that I did. First of all, some of the stuff that I showed was that took as a breakpoint 73, some of it took as a breakpoint 79, and it's somewhere in that murky period. The benefit of using 73 or 79 is that they're both business cycle peaks. So the labor market is at sort of at its top of its game. So it's a good time to compare things over time. You know, if you pick a recession, things can look a lot different. Or if you pick somewhere in the middle of the cycle, it makes comparisons harder. That's the main reason. I'd have to look at a specific example that you gave of how it could shift things in the case of women. My argument would be it can't change some of the things. It can't change the fact that there was a big decline in the 1980s, whether you start one way or the other. I mean, you're going to see that decline. And it can't change the other important fact, which is that there's a big improvement at the end of the 1990s for a lot of people. So, you know, the relative position you start at could make it look a little bit different, but I don't think it would change the story.
Have you ever done any studies of what would happen if you were to compare those, especially those first four or five charts, compare the trend in Europe versus the trend in the United
yeah.
States?
The question is, how different is the situation in Europe relative to the situation in the U.S. for a lot of the trends? And, I mean, they're vastly, vastly different. Great Britain, or the U.K. is one country that looks more or less like the United States. There have been big increases in inequality in Britain over the last, basically the same period, with one difference, that if you look at workers' wages at the bottom, middle, and the top, they've all increased substantially. So they have a fanning out process, but we have a fanning out process where people at the bottom are actually seeing declines in real wage terms, whereas they have a fanning out process, but even the people at the bottom are doing substantially better now than they were 25 years ago. If you look at almost all the rest of Europe, over the period that we're looking at, inequality has not increased terribly much. You'll get some disputes in some countries for some periods of time, but there's nothing that looks like the kinds of things that we're talking about. And I think that reinforces, in my general point, that this is about policy. This is about institutions that we have in our economy that determine how things get shared. And they've got typically much stronger institutions that share things in a much more equal way than we do. And, you know, you see the effects of that. And a lot of international organizations are criticizing European economies now for doing that, precisely because they say, you know, you should be able to grow faster if you deregulate. But, you know, I don't think that that's true. I think the experience of the U.S. contradicts that, but it's certainly an argument that people are making.
Just one more question and then I'm done.
Okay.
Have you ever studied what percentage of the decline in unions was attributable to manufacturing decline versus other factors?
I haven't done any formal study of that, and I haven't seen a formal study recently. The question is, how much of the decline in unions is just because of the decline in manufacturing? But in the graph that I showed earlier, you have some idea of what that might look like. This is the trend. This is the unionization rate. Basically, here's a situation. This is kind of, you might think of as kind of the natural decline in unions because of the fact that you have a lot of workers in manufacturing. And manufacturing productivity increases a lot. So each year you need fewer and fewer people to make the same amount of stuff. And that could mean that then you have fewer and fewer union workers since that's where most of them are. So if you kind of extend that line, you might get some simple, crude notion of what it would have looked like if just the manufacturing. And then basically the gap between extending that line and the line itself is a whole bunch of other things. You know, bad strategic choices by the labor movement mixed with, you know, a full incredible assault on the labor movement by, you know, government and corporate corporations. And I think that's what's happening there. The question is whether or not the increase, which you can sort of see that big jump, I think it's 1962, by essentially almost by fiat, by just signing a document, John F. Kennedy transformed a whole bunch of workers into union workers or union eligible workers. If it might be more accurate to look at the trend a little before then as what was happening, and that could certainly be the case. The only thing is, you do have a big jump up, and then you kind of basically organize a lot of the public sector without a huge opposition or fight, and then I think the trend continues. But trying to divide, we've had very stable numbers of manufactured workers for the last 10 or 15 years. I mean, it's declining somewhat, but I mean, if you look at the numbers, they haven't fallen a turbo amount in the 90s because we actually had a little bit of a move up at the end of the 90s, and yet unionization rates continue to fall. I mean, so I think it's it could be overblown, the role of manufacturing a little bit in the decline, but it's clearly important. I just think that there's some other factors which really are, policy issues. And then there's a question of, there's nothing inherent about why you can't organize in the service sector, right? I mean, what makes it hard is that the legal system is not very amenable to it, and you're starting very late in the game. It's not like organizing, you already had all the auto and steel workers, organized, and you just have to kind of keep them until, so. But there are people who know way more about this particular issue than I do, and I'd refer you to their work. So. Anything? Yeah.
Can we talk just briefly about the relationship between healthcare coverage and wages?
This is one of the graphs that is the propaganda graphs on the end, the free ones, the extras. And the question is, what is the relationship between wages and healthcare coverage? I don't have. Oh, actually, I do have it on here because I. Come on! Oh, doing the wrong thing. This graph shows healthcare coverage rates by the wage quintile. So basically, you divide everyone's work, all of wage earners, into five groups. The bottom fifth, the next fifth, the middle fifth, the next fifth, and then the top fifth. And you look at the share of workers in those wages, in those wage ranges, that actually have health insurance coverage. And what's striking is two things here. One, wrong way. You have a big gap between top wage workers have almost 80% coverage. Bottom wage workers have about 25% coverage, and you see it sort of smoothly increasing across. The other thing that's pretty striking, especially in the 1980s, is how there were big declines in coverage across the board, but they were especially bad at the bottom. And this kind of got reversed a little bit. It's measuring the share. The question is, what kind of change is this measuring? It's measuring the share of people who have employer-provided coverage where part of or all of their premium is paid. So the relationship here is, basically, if you have a good job, it pays well and it has health insurance. If you have a bad job, it doesn't pay so well and it doesn't have health insurance. And over the course of the 1980s and 1990s, what you've seen is that workers at the bottom have disproportionately, of the pay scale, have disproportionately lost their health insurance benefits. So it's not particularly shocking, but the numbers are pretty striking. And to compare a situation with Europe, this would be a non-issue because essentially every European country that we trade with internationally and that we go on vacation in, and if we're lucky enough, they would have 100% coverage. It wouldn't be an issue. Is that helpful? Okay. If we don't have any more questions, we can end it there. It's 8:00. Okay, thanks.